If you're a fan of the Resilient Recruiter podcast, I've got exciting news. I'm hosting a special event for recruitment business owners in London on September 17th and 18th, and I'd love you to join us. If you want to achieve your full potential, you need to surround yourself with the right people. At the Recruitment Coach Live Summit, you'll get to meet some of my podcast guests in person, hang out with us, and share ideas. Some of the folks I've interviewed on the show will either be attending or speaking at the summit. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and today I am thrilled to be joined by one of our clients, Hugh Pocock.
I was born on a farm, Mark. My grandfather was a farmer, dairy farmer. My mother was part of the farming family, but we were never going to have a farm, but she was very fortunate enough to have a house on his farm. And so I pretty much grew up around cows and sheep. And that for me as a childhood was amazing.
Hugh is the founding director of Cultura Connect, which is a recruiting firm specializing in agriculture, food, and the forestry sectors.
We're quite targeted on the route we're looking at, and that's the ag tech world. So that's bringing technology into the farming industry. That could be there's an awful lot of sensors out there that could be monitoring the temperature of the soil to know when the perfect time to plant the crop is. It could be predicting the yield that's in the field from a satellite image. Could be using drone technology to go and map a field.
Hugh founded the business in 2020 alongside his business partner, Tom Marsh. And since then, they've successfully merged Hugh's 20 years experience in the agricultural industry with Tom's 20 plus years experience in recruitment.
My son was playing tennis one Sunday morning, and I was sitting next to this chap whose son was playing tennis. And it happened to be my business partner, Tom, who is now my business partner. But at the time, we were talking about what I was thinking of doing. He said, well, I'm in recruitment. If you ever get stuck, Hugh, let me know. I might be able to help you find people. And I was thinking, well, okay, this guy doesn't know agriculture, but he might be able to help me find people.
Since its inception, Cultura Connect has grown rapidly. They're now a team of 13 with specialist knowledge and experience in agriculture and related industries.
People, getting the right people, people that really understand the industry. That's allowed us to be seen as the agricultural specialist, the forestry specialist, food specialist, because we've got that team of individuals. All those individuals are passionate about that. They're passionate about doing a good job. They're committed.
Hugh, welcome. I'm excited that we're finally doing this.
Thank you, Mark. I'm excited too.
Fantastic. So I know you're passionate about nurturing and developing talent in the agricultural, food, and forestry industries, and leveraging your unique background and insights in that in those fields to help your clients build effective teams. Where does your passion from agriculture come from? Give me a bit of background and context into that.
Blimey. Well, I was born on a farm, Mark. So my grandfather was a farmer, dairy farmer, and my mother was part of the farming family, but we were never going to have a farm, but she was very fortunate enough to have a house on his farm. And so I pretty much grew up around cows and sheep. And that for me as a childhood was amazing. I think the first animal pet I had was a ferret, a rabbit, and then a sheep, and then a cow. And then I got involved in showing cows. And I guess the rest is history in terms of my love of the outdoors and farming.
Wow, that's awesome. By the way, I took my family on a vacation to Oswestry. How far is that from your farm?
Not far at all. So where I grew up, it was probably only about 20 minutes away.
Okay, amazing. So you grew up in your grandparents' dairy farm. And then how did you get into the agricultural industry yourself once you had your own pets and pet cow and everything?
Yep, for me, Mark, I was very fortunate, really. There's a young members organization called Holston Young Breeders. And from the age of about seven, my uncle encouraged me to take some young animals to a show. So these are baby calves. They're probably 3 or 4 months old at that age. And the discipline of taking them to a show, giving them a wash, giving them a haircut, making me look smart with a white coat on and clean shoes was where it all started. And that love of doing that and that movement opened my eyes to bigger things. And I got involved in sort of national competitions, whether it was showing animals, whether it was giving them a haircut or judging. And that then led me on to wanting to, well, people actually said, don't go into farming. There is no future in it. But I just ignored them and said, there's got to be. So I ended up then going off to agricultural college. And from there, I guess the passion continued whilst I was there. I was earning beer money, giving cows haircuts. I had to start doing that for a company, a cattle breeding company called Cogent, which at the time was owned by the Duke of Westminster. And I was doing some work for them, and eventually came to me and said, Hugh, you're costing us a fortune, all this extra work you're doing whilst you're at college. Would you consider working for us? And I thought, well, I never really thought of a job in the genetics world. And that's exactly what I got into then. And that's where my career kind of blossomed from there. They offered me a very low salary as a graduate. And it was an awful lot of fun.
And you worked your way up from there. At what stage did you and your wife start your own farm?
I guess I've been working for those guys for about 15 years. And after probably about 6 years of working there, my wife and I wanted to sort of move away from sort of, we bought and sold a couple of houses in local villages, but both been brought up on a farm. My wife was a dairy farmer's daughter. We wanted to live out in the countryside. So we actually started renting a farmhouse with a few acres. My passion for livestock continued. I got a few sheep and we did that for 10 years. And I happened to speak to my landlord one day and said, if a bigger farm comes up, would you let me know? I'd be interested in having a few more acres. So we went from having 10 acres and then overnight he said, another farm's come up. Would you be interested? I said, yeah, I'd love to. Let's come have a look. And he said, how about this one? It was 150 acres.
So wow.
Gone from just have a few sheep to actually go, okay, we've got to be full-blown farmers here. And so then I took on the opportunity of being a farmer back in, proper farmer, I guess, in 2016.
Wow, that's amazing. So it's such a beautiful part of the country as well. Is it Whitchurch?
Yes, Whitchurch, Shropshire.
So how many animals have you got?
Oh my goodness. We've probably now we've got about 100 head of cattle and around 200 sheep.
Wow, that's it's so different to my background, but it's fascinating. And why did you decide on Wagyu beef?
Okay, so the story gets a bit elongated from here, Mark. So always had that passion for cattle, as you heard in my younger days, showing dairy cattle. But whilst I was working for Cogent Cattle Breeding Company, we'd sold the house we were living in, we were renting. We wanted to invest our money in something a bit different. And we came across a property that had a butcher shop with it. And we considered converting this butcher shop and a four-bedroom house into some flats. And when we bought it, everyone said, Hugh, this butcher shop's been here for nearly 300 years. That you can't close it. And we're like, oh, gosh. We'd sold a bit of meat out of the freezer from home. And we ended up deciding we'd actually take this butcher shop on. My wife kind of modernized it, gave it that kind of nice Italian style to it, and it was a huge success. But one of the things that drew my attention to Wagyu cattle was the fact we had the butcher shop. Someone came up to me one day and said, I've got these Wagyu cattle. Nobody really knows what to do, and would you consider selling them in your shop? And I said, yeah, I'd give it a go. I'll sell some. So I did, and my customers really liked it. And from there, I got a real passion for – I always had a passion for great food anyway – got a passion for the Wagyu breeding. I got asked to sit on the Wagyu breeders board and that then continued on. And then I've got my own Wagyu cattle on my own farm. So slightly longer story than probably what I expected there. But
no, this is, so what's unique about your situation, Hugh, and why I thought this would be really interesting to have you on the show is because I'm sure there may be some out there, but I personally have never met somebody who has a full working farm, which in itself is I would have thought a full-time business, and you're growing a recruitment company at the same time. So how did you get into recruiting?
Okay. So I guess that takes me back to my career then at Cogent. So I started pretty much as what I felt as a T-boy and a low salary, but effectively I went through lots of different jobs. So I did a couple of years looking at how the cattle were breeding out in the field, the bulls were performing. I did a couple of years buying genetics. I did a few years then running the genetics business, so traveling the world, creating the strategy for the future direction of the breeding program. And then did a number of years managing the UK sales team. From then we got involved in mergers and acquisitions. I then got involved in international business development. And I had chance to take voluntary redundancy from that business when they were packaging up to sell it. And that's when I had a chance to go and do some consultancy. I decided I didn't want to work for someone for a few years because I just worked for a company for 16 years. what else was out there. So I actually had opportunity to work on a number of different projects. What I've realized then was I was combining all of my knowledge that I've built up over those 16 years in the business of different parts of the business, understanding business, and then getting involved in consulting. And I was working for companies that were in rapid expansion phase. They were needing people there to help them grow. And I was often asked, do you know anybody that can help us grow this business? And that's really where the idea of recruitment came from. I was thinking, hang on, I really understand this industry. I really understand this business. I know people from my black book, my network I've built up over the years that could do that really well. And these people go, wow, you really understand this. And then I thought, hang on, there's a bit more to this. We could create an opportunity. So I explored it a little bit. And I played around with it. And that's really where the story continues, because my son was playing tennis one Sunday morning, and I was sitting next to this chap whose son was playing tennis. And it happened to be my business partner, Tom, who is now my business partner. But at the time we were talking about what I was thinking of doing. He said, well, I'm in recruitment. If you ever get stuck, you let me know. I might be able to help you find people. And I was thinking, well, okay, this guy doesn't know agriculture, but he might be able to help me find people. So I started working on an assignment. I got one great client, sorry, great candidate for a client. And the client said, yeah, fantastic, Hugh, could I see a few more? And in my naivety, I said, okay, yeah, I'll go and find you some more candidates. So off I went, trying to find more candidates. In the meantime, that first candidate got another job,
right,
and I couldn't find enough. So I thought, right, I'll pick up the phone to Tom, see if he could help me out. Tom, could you help? Yeah, sure. Off he went and found me a few CVs using LinkedIn and I guess CV library and various other sources. Found me some CVs. I looked and yeah, these look quite good. I interviewed them. And then as I interviewed, I was, yep, this person is perfect for our client. I'll send them across. Client's very happy. Great. I thought, hey, this is all right. I've got the client. I understand what's required. I've got someone that can go and source me CVs. So I thought, we'll try this again. So we went out and talked to a few other people about what I was doing. Yeah, can you help us find someone here? Off I went. Tom, can you help us? Tom found me the CVs. I then interviewed them, qualified them. Yep, great. Send them to the clients. Clients, fantastic. I thought, this is brilliant. Then it materialized that Tom's wife was also a dairy farmer's daughter, and the whole thing started to click together. This started to work quite well. And Tom and I said, well, let's give this thing a go. And back in 2020, we launched Cultural Connect.
Wow, that's so cool. There's a theme running through this, Hugh, of kind of, I don't want to say serendipity, let's call it being opportunistic and leveraging, like having opportunities present themselves and just grabbing hold of them with, you know, expanding your farm, first of all, and then there was the butcher shop, and then there was the, you know, consulting clients who are expanding and they're like, hey, we need staff. And then you're like, hey, I could fill those jobs. And then meeting Tom, your son's playing tennis together. It's amazing. So you officially launched the business together in 2020. Talk me through the kind of key stages from that point over the next 4 or 5 years to getting to the point now where you have a thriving business, you've got 13 people on board, and you've really built a recognizable brand in your industry.
Yeah, it's amazing, really. If you think, gosh, 5 years already, it's just coming up now. We incorporated November 19, and we launched officially in the January 2020. And part of that success, I've got to put down to our supporting team initially, which is obviously Tom and I, but our respective wives got involved in the business. So my wife, Kate, had got a marketing background, obviously agricultural background. So we kind of said, Kate, we're thinking of launching this. Can you help us on that? So she then sort of did all the marketing, got the website going, the brand, getting her name out, very good on social media, that got going. And then Kim's background was also a little bit in recruitment, but also executive support. So she got involved in helping us. And we sort of bumbled along, I guess, for 12, 18 months, doing a great job, gaining clients, successfully filling roles. And then it's that time, do you expand in taking that first person on? And everyone you speak to go, well, taking that first one is the biggest leap of faith. But once you've got one, you'll not stop. You'll just keep going. And I was like, oh, not sure. And we sat there, cogitated for weeks on whether we should take somebody on. And it just so happened we were interviewing a young lady for a couple of roles. And I was just sitting there listening to her thinking, actually, you know quite a lot about lots of different things in agriculture. And that's what I guess we've prided ourselves on, is having a broad knowledge of the sector. And I said, I know we're talking about this other job, but would you be interested in working with us? And she said, well, I hadn't thought about that. So then went and talked to the team, and then said, well, yeah, this sounds quite good. We met this lady, and she joined our team. And I don't know what on earth she thought she was coming into, because obviously two husband and wife team coming along. She was our first employee. Induction day was, we'd hired a meeting room. This is what we're trying to do. And she just hit the ground running. It was fantastic. And then very quickly after that, literally within a week or two of us agreeing to take this lady on, we got approached by another lady from another recruitment company that works in our sector and said, you know, I quite like what you guys are doing. I'm not particularly happy with the culture and the business I'm at. Would you be interested in me joining your team? And we thought, well, blimey, we'd only thought about having one on. We hadn't thought about any budget for another one, but we took the opportunity, and she came on board, brought quite a few of her clients with her, and was been in recruitment for 15 years. So she got a lot of experience. So that just helped us kind of keep going. And then literally every 6 months or so, we've taken on one or two more. We've recently taken on a marketing resource to support Kate, because that was getting quite big. One of the team members that we took on initially as a recruitment consultant is now helping us more on that, I guess, job descriptions, getting all the marketing, the detailed workings out there. And that's been a big benefit to the business. And then most recently, we've taken on a gentleman that's looking at our global recruitment. So something we've always thought there was an opportunity at, and particularly in the space of agriculture and technology to combine, so ag tech. And so Rob joined our business back in the summer. And now he's got his clients all over the globe. We've got clients down in Australia, America, Morocco, Holland. And then we'd already got a few international clients as well that were wanting people in the UK. So all of a sudden, we've gone from just me and Tom to this big team. And that in itself has challenges, though, Mark, as you probably know.
Absolutely. Well, we'll get to the challenges. But so that was a great sort of 5-minute overview of 5 years of growth. But take me back to early days. You have a lot of experience in the agricultural business, but not in recruiting. How were you getting your clients? Like, what was your method? How did you approach the market in order to win those first assignments?
So the very first assignments were, I guess, based on conversations that I was having whilst out and about networking, doing consulting for a number of clients. Yep. And just happened to say, look, I'm doing this now. If you're interested in getting some help with finding people, let me know. And that started, and we had one or two. And I can tell you now, Mark, I think we probably only asked work for the first three. And since then, we haven't asked for any business. It's all come to us.
That's crazy. Let's circle back to that and talk about, mind you, I don't know if that's a good thing, Hugh. We need a new business engine as well. But
we do. Yeah. Well, that's coming. That's with Rob. So that's that international stuff is
okay.
Where we're now having to, so we're asking for it.
You approached people in your network that you already had a relationship with and said, "Look, this is I'm doing this recruiting thing, you know," and they gave you work. Give me a flavor of the sorts of positions that you guys are filling.
We are quite broad, and we made that as a strategic decision. So we will do anything from a graduate all the way up to a CEO and everything in between. We feel that that is important for the longevity of our business. We're not in this for the short term. We're in it for a long-term business growth. And often those middle managers, the graduates, in today's world where there's a shortage of candidates, can quite quickly become senior managers within the business. And we're seeing it now, even 5 years in, people we placed in a middle management role are now, you know, general managers, managing directors, even in approaching C-suite level. So working right across the board is absolutely key for us. We work with some direct farm roles. So some people ask us, how much do you do directly for people that are working on farms? So we do a little bit of that, more senior type appointments, herd managers, farm directors. We tend to shy away from the everyday stuff. More working with companies that understand how to manage their staff is really key, because farmers are very traditional in terms, not all farms, but some farmers are traditional in the way they manage people. It's a family business. It might be an owner-occupier and they have one employee. That owner-occupier might work 100 hours a week and then expect their employees to do the same. And that doesn't work in this current climate now, where there's lots of opportunities for people, not just in our industry.
Okay, interesting. So you do some work directly with farms, but mainly it's suppliers to farms, I guess.
Yeah, supplying to the farming industry as a whole. So if you took a dairy farmer, so producing milk for our table, there'd probably be over 100 different types of companies supplying products and services. So whether that's genetics that we've talked about, it could be sheds, it could be machinery, it could be professional advice, accountancy, consultancy, could be veterinarians. All of those are supply industry supplying into a farmer, and that's the industry that we focus on. It's quite broad. I know a lot of people, when I listen to on your podcast, are very narrow in terms of their reach, but then they'd be working with a much bigger. So if you took accountancy, for example, that could work right across any industry, whereas we are focusing on the agricultural, food and forestry industry. We have to be quite broad because there's lots of different things that are going on within that sector.
Okay, fantastic. Makes sense. So let's talk about your building of a team, because this is one of the key challenges that business owners face if they do have ambition. They want to build a company and not just have a very small family business with one or two people. And you've navigated that successfully. Not only that, but I believe you guys are all working remotely. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay. So that I feel makes it even more challenging, because from a training point of view, from a point of view of creating culture, creating that camaraderie. So you explained how you got your first person because you were interviewing her for other related jobs. And actually, just a side note for our listeners, this is a great source of hires for your own company, is the candidates that you're interviewing, right? Because they have experience in the functions and in the industries that you specialize in. And so that's definitely an overlooked source of internal hires. So you obviously did that successfully. And then you are recruiting from a competitor as well. So you had a mixture of people who are new to recruiting, but with, you know, agricultural experience. Then you had someone who had the recruiting experience. How did things kind of develop from there? And what is your overall approach when it comes to hiring?
Okay, so our approach to hiring is we always want to make sure that people understand our industry. That's one of our USPs. And it's one of the frustrations that I had prior to setting this company up, was working with recruitment agencies that had people that didn't really understand the industry particularly well, haven't got a lot of life experience and understanding business and what makes businesses work. So that's something that I've always had a bit of a bee in my bonnet, I guess, in terms of the sort of people we need. So everybody in our business has got some link to farming, and most of them were born on farms. So that, I guess, that remains our USP. Everyone has a really good understanding of our industry. And obviously we've gone broader into food and forestry, and people within our team have got that experience as well. In terms of getting those people, we have a mix of people that have had some recruitment experience and some that have non-experience, but have got the capability to build relationships, like that fast pace of recruitment. And as you know, in recruitment, Mark, the name of your podcast has got to be resilient. That's something I've learned the hard way. It is a real roller coaster, isn't it? Recruitment.
Yes. Absolutely. So, Hugh, what is the mixture of people who already had recruiting experience and people who you kind of trained from scratch?
Yeah, so I think now out of the 13, there's four that had recruitment experience previously. So the rest of us have no recruitment at all.
I think you're doing it right. I think there's huge benefits to both of those types of profiles. And sometimes I find that owners are very close-minded. Like they have a view, well, we only want to hire experienced people because we don't have the time or inclination to train people. We want them to hit the ground running, which is that's never the case anyway. You always need to train people, even if they have experience. And then others who are, oh no, we don't want someone who's got baggage, bad habits, or, you know, we want to train someone from scratch. And so we will only hire somebody who's a trainee and build them up. And I just think, why put any limits surely the most important thing is you're hiring the right person, right? The right mindset, the right attitude, who, as you say, is resilient, is likes the fast pace, wants to work hard. And, you know, that takes priority over experience, background, and everything else. Because you can train people to give them the skills, but you can't really train the character, the values, and the, you know, the mindset and the, you know, the self-motivation. So I love what you're doing there. Where do these hire, like, how do you find people though? Because that's always a challenge as well. And you're in I guess the remote lends itself, but are the people that you're hiring local relative to you, or are they throughout the country?
Yeah, good question, Mark. I know you mentioned, you know, we are fully remote as a business, so we haven't let geography actually get in our way. So it meant that we've been able to get some exceptional people, and they don't have to be close. We've got quite a few that are close to us. So we're based in Shropshire. Tom is just in just over the border in Cheshire. So most of the team would be focused around there, but we've got someone down in Berkshire, someone in Wiltshire, someone in Herefordshire, and then the rest would be fairly close to us now. But I'm certainly not against someone working in Ireland, North America, anywhere else in the world, if they bring in the right attributes to us. So in terms of finding people, they've pretty much found us. Working with you, Mark, on the Apex program, you know, you've always said, keep an eye out for talent. And so we've always got an open door. So if someone comes knocking on our door saying, hey, I see what you guys are doing, I like it, we'll look at you. We'll look at that individual. And when we are ready for taking people on, if we are interviewing people, then we're always sort of bearing that in mind. And the team are sort of also mindful of that and keeping an eye out. And quite a few of our hires have come from recommendations, friends of people already working with us. So that works well.
Awesome. And yes, so you know, my philosophy is always be interviewing, you know, even if you haven't got a higher plan for this month or this quarter. You know, if a great person comes along, then let's interview them, because the right person will create, you know, will pay for themselves, obviously. And internal employee referrals are such a huge resource in terms of finding other people, because good people know other good people, of course. It's a principle we apply when we're recruiting for our clients, right? We're networking candidates we already know. Who do they know who might be good? And so, and I don't know why we wouldn't apply that to our own, you know, internal team as well. Do you have any kind of referral bonus, or how do you encourage people to make those recommendations?
So we don't have anything official on that front, Mark, but all of our recruitment team are incentivized to fill positions. So if we end up filling a position with somebody they've referred to us or brought in, then they would get some reward for doing that on top of the standard package.
Great. Okay, fantastic. So you've grown the team to 13, and from what you described, it makes it sound almost like this has been a walk in the park, right? Like your clients come to you, your team members come to you, you've attracted, you know, this tremendous opportunity, you know, both commercially as well as, you know, the human resource. But what have been some of the roadblocks or challenges that that you've encountered along the journey?
Gosh, there's several roadblocks, I guess, that have come along. I guess the first one that we had to get our heads around was this remote working piece. We set the business up just before COVID, so we actually found it becoming the norm doing lots of interviews online. It wasn't the norm at the time, so that's became one of our USPs, is interviewing all of our candidates via a video call. And so when it came to expanding the team, we thought, actually, this is working quite well. We're all working from home. We've got no overheads. Why don't we allow everybody to work from home? There posed the first challenge was when you induct a member of the team. So you're all working remotely. So gradually, as we've progressed and matured, we put in place an induction plan that allows people to come up and spend time in the Shropshire, Cheshire area. Fortunately, one of the properties above our butcher shop is an Airbnb apartment, so they can come and stay there. They'll spend a few days then either working from my house or Tom's house, or we'll hire a meeting room and we'll all come together. So that was, I guess, one of the early challenges was getting that induction right. And I don't think we've got it right yet, because the more time you spend on that, the better it will be.
Definitely. Let me just pause there for a second, because there's a couple of follow-ups. Number one is, I think you're absolutely right. Like, every time you hire a new person, your onboarding and induction program is just going to keep getting better. As long as, obviously, that's your mindset, as you're working on it, you're refining it, each iteration, you notice some missing pieces that you can incorporate. But so I love that you are bringing, even though people work remotely, generally speaking, you are creating opportunities to meet people in real life, in particular when they do their induction training. How long do they spend with you?
So it's usually the first week. It's probably 3 to 4 days is where it's fairly intense. But the other thing that we've done to kind of aid with this remote working and getting everyone working together as a team is every 6 weeks, the team has an opportunity to come together. So we work with a local university, Harper Adams, where I got my degree, and there's opportunity to hire rooms there. So we'll hire a room and the whole team are invited so they can come along, spend the day. Just working from there allows us to have one-to-one meetings. We can have some group chats about what's going on, but certainly when someone's new into the business, they can come along, feel part of it. We can catch up on a few bits that they're not sure about, that, and we would allow them to come up for 2 or 3 days again. So then they can go and spend, they might buddy up with another team member and shadow them and work out of that hired meeting room, or come to my house or Tom's house again, just to get that sort of top up of information that's required. And we will do that every 6 weeks.
That's awesome. So this is the first real golden nugget I think everybody should take away, is even if you're remote, is have a cadence of regular in-person opportunities where everyone comes together. How did you decide on every 6 weeks?
We just felt that was quite a nice break, but also what we do is every 3 months, every quarter, we bring the team together for some kind of activity. So we've done lots of different things over the last few years. So we early on this summer, we went on a walk up the local hills, but we actually went down to Mandy's area, which is down in Herefordshire, walked on the Malvern Hills. Everyone took a dog. We had a lovely walk, had something to eat, and we all got together and had a nice day out. We did a canoeing trip back in the summer. So we all set off from a location on canoes. We went downriver. We stopped actually at my cousin's farm and had a picnic on the riverbank, ended up in the local town. And the next day we got together and then we did a bit of group training. And so that happens every 3 months. So every 6 weeks is kind of in the middle as well. So we know that all these things are going on, but we always make a point of, when we do get together, we try and let our hair down. It's not just about work. It's just about, you know, getting time together, having something to eat, something to drink, telling stories, and just having a bit of fun.
Love this, Hugh. This is really, really cool. Doing those team building days once a quarter, I think, is phenomenal. By the way, I took my boys quad biking on a sheep farm in Welshpool, so I can recommend them. They were really good, actually. I can find the name for you if you're interested. But so this is brilliant. I think not enough companies really invest the. So it's investing that time and money. And I think the challenge is it's hard to measure ROI from that, right? And so, and it can be a big cost, because you're paying for people to travel, you're paying for the activity itself, but it's also the downtime of, you know, people are taking a day or two kind of out of the business. How do you quantify the positive impact that can have for your business?
It's difficult, like you said, as a return on investment. The one way we look at it is the fact that we don't have huge overheads of an office, so we don't mind spending that little bit extra when they come together and having a good time. But you can see the uplift in energy within the team for days following getting together. Productivity seems to increase. Collaborative working is better. So we always see the positive signs of it.
Yeah, no doubt. Absolutely. I think what you've created is like the perfect balance for a remote team. So your overheads are much lower, especially than like imagine having commercial office space, a lease in a major urban, you know, center is hugely expensive. But then you're reinvesting some of those savings on creating these experiences where the team can bond. But also, I love the almost the cadence of this. So you've got the quarterly team building and training and get together, social, etc. And then exactly halfway between that, every 6 weeks, you've got the in-person where you're working together. So what that enables is you've almost got, there's always something to look forward to. And that kind of gives everyone that lift and re-energizes people. And so I can see that having a really positive impact on productivity as well as retention, because you really get to know people on a more personal level. So I think that's brilliant, Hugh.
Yeah. One thing I would add into there as well, Mark, is that when we was regularly speaking to the team, so we have a full team meeting every Monday morning for about an hour and a half, going through all of the roles. So everybody collectively knows what's going on and everyone can feed into that. We'll meet also all again on a Wednesday for a shorter period of time, just going through any new roles that have come on and any roles that people are struggling with to kind of share ideas. So that brings everybody together. But also we found that anybody new coming on board, if we see they're struggling, sometimes they're struggling from working from home because they've been used to working in an office or just a totally different environment. We'll encourage them to come and spend a day with us or one of the team members. So if they want to go and meet in a coffee room and spend the day together, they can. And the team have been really good at that. We're going, okay, yeah, I can support you. I'm happy. I'd love to. And one girl, she now works out of a local hotel a couple of days a week. Another lady works at a hotel and spa a couple of days a week. So they mix it up a bit as well and just creates that more enjoyable working environment.
That's what's brilliant about that is that the support and the support system doesn't just come from you and Tom, right? It's them helping their peers, which is fantastic. I love that. Were there any other kind of big challenges that you have, either disappointments, setbacks, or constraints that you had to figure out in order to continue growing?
I think we're the last 6 months have probably been the toughest 6 months for us. We've built a big team. The work has come. It just keeps coming, which is great. Rob with the international work is bringing lots of work in now. So that's added additional work in, which is fantastic. I think the controlling, as I said to the team, controlling the controllables is the bit that we're working on right now. And actually listened to one of the Apex sessions that we had back in July, Mark. I think the guy was it Matt Walsh? Yeah, Matt gave a great nugget of advice that when we were concluding the session. I said, if there's one thing, Matt, that you wouldn't change with what you've done over the years, what would it be? And he said, having a weekly meeting with my clients is essential. And if the client doesn't want to meet with you weekly, then you shouldn't be working with them. So we instigated that immediately and we've seen a massive improvement in that, because one of the challenges that we've had is controlling candidates and controlling clients. Because when they're both out of control, you're in the lap of the gods, it's down to luck. And so much is about luck in recruitment, but actually if you can control two elements, which is candidates, so communicating regularly, understand what's going on with those guys, and then the clients as well. So actually, again, the clients bought in the fact that actually we'd be working with you every week. We just want 5 minutes of your time so we can give you an update of what's going on. That's been a game changer for us. And we're just starting to see the benefits of that now after several months of operation.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing that. And shout out to Matt Walsh. We'll link to my previous podcast interview with him below. I caught up in person with Matt just a couple of weeks ago in Atlanta. He's a member of the Pinnacle Society. In fact, he's our education chair. So he was the one that invited me over to speak. And as you alluded to, one of the things that we do with our coaching program is we invite special guests to come and do a private Q&A session on a regular basis to, you know, just bring as much expertise and knowledge and different perspectives as possible. So controlling the controllables, absolutely. Any other kind of obstacles or challenges that you've had to navigate?
Yeah, I guess majority of our business has been contingency. You know, the industry we work in terms of agriculture is very traditional. It's almost like a handshake. You almost don't need to have a contract, but we do, you know, standard practice. But one of the challenges of contingency is cash flow, because you can be working on a job and you could be working on it for a couple of months, and then you've got 3 months before the candidate starts on the notice period. So you're 5 months without cash. And particularly when you've got those two controllables not being controlled, that extends your issue around cash flow. So our cash flow has been incredibly tight the last few months. I can see light at the end of the tunnel now. So one of the things we have done to try and mitigate that with Rob coming in is doing more retained work and sort of variety of retained options, whether it's a deposit or whether it's a fully retained. So that's helping quite a bit. It's keeping our clients more engaged. It's helping with the cash flow. But again, it all takes time to get to that point.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything takes time. I think that's the challenge, right? Is managing, because recruiters and, you know, entrepreneurs tend not to be the most patient. And we, you know, but from implementing something, even if you're doing everything right, you know, sometimes it can be a matter of weeks or months before you see the results of that. So, just back up a second, Hugh, because something that may be surprising to some people, you mentioned a 3 month notice period. Like, is that the norm, or is that like only the most senior positions? What's the, because I would have thought 4 weeks notice is standard. What's a scenario where someone would have 3 months notice?
It's amazing how many companies have now got 3 months notice, particularly the more senior roles. You'd expect that, and some beyond that, up to 6 months in the senior ones. I remember one particular example a couple of years ago now for us. We started working on a senior farm appointment, a farm director, and the search itself took several months. Eventually, the whole interview process then took a couple of months. Person had his notice in, 6 months notice. So actually, from the moment we started, the moment they started was 12 months. So we didn't get paid for 12 months on that role. So hence why we want to do more retained work, because a role like that, you know, should be. But that gives you kind of idea of how that can really impact your cash flow.
Not only that, I imagine the international roles take longer as well. If they involve, like, are you relocating people, or are you just recruiting people in other countries, but from within that country?
It's from within that country typically, but there will be some relocation that goes on.
Okay. So like you're recruiting Dutch people for Holland companies Americans for American companies, but you're not necessarily moving like exporting talent or...
No, that would be another challenge again, Mark.
Interesting. So, but Hugh, tell me about this international expansion then, because that could be massive. Like what? It's one thing recruiting like for British farms or British agricultural industry. But now, once you open up to other countries, how do you even decide, you know, where the opportunities are, where to target? Because you've suddenly like increased the size of your potential market by, I would imagine, you know, 20 times.
You could say that, but actually what we're doing is we're quite targeted on the route we're looking at, and that's the ag tech world. So that's bringing technology into the farming industry. That could be there's an awful lot of sensors out there that could be monitoring the temperature of the soil to know when the perfect time to plant the crop is. It could be predicting the yield that's in the field from a satellite image. It could be using drone technology to go and map a field, spray a field. So it's using stuff that hasn't necessarily been used in agriculture, but deploying it in agriculture. So that allows us to kind of pinpoint a small group of companies, and often those are startup and scale up businesses that are needing sort of top talent, allow them to go to the next stage before they either get sold out or, you know, swallowed up by one of the big companies. So that's keeping it quite targeted at the moment, but I'm certain from that it will start to grow legs and
Okay, that makes more sense. I completely understand now. So although it's an international expansion, it is within a specific niche, which is ag tech, and that makes sense. Is it ag or agri tech? What's the correct?
There's lots of different takes on it. Ag tech or agri tech. Yeah.
Okay. So this is really cool. So although you said that you recruit throughout the industry, it sounds like you do have niches that you concentrate on within the overall business. How does that break down?
I guess a little bit is to do with the knowledge that we have within our team. So my knowledge, as we probably heard earlier in the podcast, is sort of the cattle, the livestock background. So naturally, a lot of sort of livestock type base roles would come my way. And quite a few of the team are from that sort of livestock background. But a number of the team have got different skill sets. As I mentioned, you know, some have got the food background, and, you know, that allows us to sort of work within that sector.
The food industry by itself is huge. I know a recruiting business here in Edinburgh, and they only do food manufacturing throughout the UK. I think they've got about 80 people just doing that.
Food is huge, but we've narrowed that down a little bit to be agri-food. So that's that kind of link to farming. So quite a lot of integrated businesses would need people that understand the growing of a crop or growing of animals, and then right the way through then to that finished item that's on a shelf. That's where we would sort of interact.
Okay. All right. Fantastic. This is cool. So circling back to cash flow then, like as an entrepreneur and you've got lots of experience, both running your own business as well as working for others, what's the solution to improving cash flow? And getting paid up front is definitely, you know, I think huge. Any other things that you're pursuing?
Yeah, I guess better control of our systems and processes. You know, we're looking at all of our metrics all the time. So a number of jobs that are coming in, number of submissions that are going on, so that we've got a handle of where we are within the process. And as I said, improving the process, one of those things is those weekly calls with our clients that makes a big difference, but also with the candidates, keeping them informed. Make sure that you've got the appropriate number of jobs per recruiter, that they're not overworked, that they can't keep up with the clients and the candidates. That's also key, because we've had it where we are probably understaffed, where we're running around trying to look after everybody, actually end up don't do a very good job with anybody. So that's also it causes an issue.
Definitely. In fact, so what is the magic number of roles per consultant?
I don't know whether I've got a magic number yet, Mark, but probably they'd be looking between 15 and 20 roles that they'll be working on, and they'll all be at different stages. So you've probably got 25% that are just starting out. So the briefing, doing the initial searches, getting the adverts out there, and then you've got 25% that maybe speaking to candidates, and there'll be 25% going through the interview process and 25% accepted jobs, but still keeping them warm and making sure we're interacting with them.
Okay, that makes sense. So when I was growing up as a contingency recruiter, then we were told we always needed 20 plus jobs at one time. But to be honest with you, Hugh, they weren't all high quality B plus A, you know, jobs. So 15 to 20 really good fillable opportunities makes more sense. And then as I shifted more to getting paid up front and with committed searches, then that also meant I worked on fewer things at once, because I wasn't spinning quite so many plates, which actually suited me better. I'm not brilliant at multitasking and, you know, splitting my focus between 20 different things. So to me, having fewer things that had a higher probability of closing suited my style much better. So Q, I don't know, were you at the last Apex meeting on Tuesday?
No, I was away on holiday this week.
Okay. Oh, you're on holiday. So it's funny because coincidentally, this was the topic we talked about, is increasing profit and improving cash flow. So be sure to watch that recording. One of the keys that we talked about was debtor days, how to reduce the number of debtor days. What's your average, you know, time to get paid? And there's a blog article, which I'll link to in this in the show notes, which is about your collections process. Like, what is your SOP for getting paid, and how are you managing the invoicing and the credit control in order to get paid faster? I think every business needs to have a tight process around that. So, looking back briefly, and we're going to look forward in a second, what do you think have been the absolute keys to your success? Because it is a success story, Hugh. Like, in just 5 years, what you've accomplished is phenomenal. If you could put it down to just two or three key ingredients, then what would those be?
People. Getting the right people that really understand the industry. That's allowed us to be seen as the agricultural specialist, the forestry specialist, food specialist, because we've got that team of individuals. All those individuals are passionate about that. They're passionate about doing a good job. They're committed. And I guess ultimately they fit with our culture. So people will be one of the key things for us.
Absolutely.
The drive and enthusiasm for industry per se is where I've gained the most sort of credibility in some respects. And that, I guess, has come from then. Growth has come from delivering it. So that customer experience, making sure that we do deliver. And when we do deliver, it's good quality. You know, submission of quality over quantity is our guarantee. Last year, when I did the metrics on this, we averaged 1.3 CVs to a placement that was submitted to
clients. Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. And a bit of that was a bit of luck, because we had a number of clients that we put two candidates forward and they go, wow, we've been looking for ages for this. Actually, we'll take both of them. So that helped the metrics somewhat. But that's increased because one of the things we realized that we needed to put more candidates forward, because sometimes it is those left field ones that will make a difference. And you think, not quite right.
You may have found the perfect candidate. There's no guarantee they're going to accept the position, right? Things, as you mentioned earlier, there's luck, and we do need to manage. That's one of the controllables is not putting all your eggs in one basket, right? And allowing for some bad luck to happen. So we've got people, and I've got some follow-up questions for these people. We've got the quality over quantity approach, and that real drive to get this right for the customer. Building your brand actually is something we've not spent enough time talking about. You mentioned your wife helped, is kind of the driving force behind the marketing. So I'd love to spend more time about that. Just before we get to that, on the people side, you mentioned you're looking for people who are passionate about the industry and committed. Like, how do you identify that? Because I think everybody listening would agree, get the right people and, you know, success is inevitable, but get the wrong people and it's a real drag on growth and on profit and on cash flow, and it really sets you back. So how do you know that the person sitting in front of you is going to fit your culture and is going to bring that passion and that drive, that enthusiasm, the resilience that you're looking for?
So I think if you go for the passion of the industry piece, which is a big part for us, when you're meeting them, you know how passionate they talk about it, the background, their upbringing, how they want to be seen in the industry. Then it comes down to the personality. You know, are they going to fit with our team? You know, are they compassionate? And I've got all my core values here on my mouse pad. So are they resilient? Can they handle that? Are they compassionate? Are they going to be able to do the right thing for the client and the candidate? They're not just going to fire a CV at a client for the sake of it. We're not in the game for doing that. Team orientated. Yes, we don't work in an office, but we do work as a team. And as I said, we will talk to the whole team about a new job coming in. So everybody's aware of it, because more people thinking about it and seeing opportunities helps. And then everyone works together. And someone that's not part of that team won't fit the culture. So that's another big thing. Integrity, doing the right thing is always right in our book. And again, submission over quality, quantity over quantity is key. Being proactive, working from home, you've got to be proactive. You can't be sitting there waiting to have an instruction. We want people to think for themselves and go, right, this is what I've got to do. This is how I'm going to get there. Ask for help if they need it, and actually want to keep growing. And everybody that we've got on our team wants to do better. So, and then the other one is that, yeah, that growth mindset would be another culture piece for us as well, is that we're working for companies that want to grow, but we're a company that wants to grow, and we will look at opportunities. And you mentioned it earlier about these opportunities come along and you've taken it. That's one of my big drive. If I ever talking to younger people coming into the industry, I'll always highlight, if you see an opportunity, look at it, don't dismiss it. It's very easy to say no, but if an opportunity comes, have a look at it. And is it something that would make a benefit? And, you know, one example of that was, we got approached by a lady who I talked to a couple of years ago about whether we'd like to acquire her forestry business. And that's how we ended up growing into the forestry sector.
Oh, wow. That's a whole nother thing we didn't talk about. So you actually acquired a small recruiting business that's focused on forestry.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. We probably won't have time to even, you know, touch that today. So maybe that's a topic for future. But so you're hiring for values fit has been key, Hugh, obviously. And I love the values that you've just shared. For the remaining time, I'd love to talk about your brand, because you are very well positioned in your industry. And what have been some of the strategies that you've adopted, apart from just doing good work, obviously, but in order to really build that brand recognition and from a marketing point of view to support the day-to-day stuff you guys are doing?
Yeah. So brand, I have to give a lot of this to our marketing, in particular, Kate, my wife, who's been very passionate about making sure that's right. And just simple things. However, whenever we are putting something out there in social media, on our website, something we're doing now, the brand is key. It's really important to have it represented in the right way. And you see so often people think, actually, we can do without that level of marketing spend. We can get the team to do it themselves. And then you lose that continuity, that context. And it always wants to look fitting with what you're trying to achieve. And constantly working on that. And if you look at some of the greatest brands in the world, like say Apple and say Amazon, for example, they are constantly working on that. It's about customer service. That's part of the brand. It's about how they're portrayed and the amount of investment they will put in based on the turnover. So we will always look around our budget time. We will look at how much we're projecting to bring in as revenue, and then a percentage of that will be allocated then to the marketing strategy.
What's the percentage, Hugh?
I think it's about 7%.
Okay, awesome. So here's another takeaway, is almost from the very beginning, you had a marketing department. Yeah, I mean, it was one person, but, and then you've expanded that. So in a company of 13, you've got two people who are focused on marketing?
Yeah, it'll be probably two and a bit heads now.
Which is fantastic. And I completely endorse what you're doing. I think recruiting traditionally is a very sales-led business, which is understandable. You know, we've got the majority of the headcount are fee earners. They're people who are directly revenue generating. But I think the recruiting industry has lagged behind in terms of sophistication of marketing, whereas you've really embraced that from the outset. What would you say were the top one or two things that have moved the needle from a marketing perspective?
Having a strong presence on multiple platforms and social media. Your audience isn't just in one place. In recruitment, most of us will turn to LinkedIn as a core focus. But actually every aspect of social media, whether you, Facebook is a big one. There's quite a few people that would be on Facebook that might not use LinkedIn. Instagram, surprisingly, is something we do quite a bit on. And, the other day we gained a client through Instagram. I was sitting with him and saying, how'd you hear about it? So he said, I've known about you guys for ages, but I just saw something on Instagram and it made me pick up the phone and speak to you.
What did he see? What was the post?
You know? He must have just seen something we were promoting around a similar role to he was looking for. Thought, well, these guys know this sector.
So this is really interesting, Hugh, because you're right. Most recruiters focus on LinkedIn to almost the exclusion of all others, whereas you're leveraging multiple social media platforms. So you mentioned obviously you are still on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram. Any others that you spend time or
we looked at TikTok, but it's not an easy one to navigate. So yeah, those would be the sort of three: LinkedIn, okay, Facebook, and Instagram.
All right, fantastic. So multi platform social media strategy. Love it, Hugh. I wish we had more time because I could chat with you for ages. So let's do it again. I mentioned to you, I'd love to visit you on your farm and do a video like in person someday, because I think it would be beautiful. I can just picture the video would be beautiful around where you are. It would be a super interesting one. So let's say to be continued.
Definitely. Yeah, look forward to it. We can have a Wagyu steak, Mark.
Well, I'm vegan, so
You can watch me eat one then.
But I'd love to meet your cows anyway. So, Hugh, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for doing it. And I'll speak to you next week.
Brilliant. Look forward to it.